Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we had the Indian Prime Minister's very productive visit to Japan, which came at a sensitive time where both Asian gray powers were trying to delicately balance between the US and China. The two leaders agreed to a $75 billion currency swap and will begin preparing for their first ever 2+2 talks between their foreign and defense ministers, as well as exploring the possibility for joint infrastructure projects in third-party states along the Indian Ocean rimland, presumably through their Asia-Africa Growth Corridor initiative. There were also reports in early October that they're discussing a so-called acquisition and cross-servicing agreement, which is, for all intents and purposes, the same pact that India signed with the US and France to allow one another to use their military facilities on a case-by-case logistical basis, which could, in theory, expand the Japanese Self-Defense Force's role in the Indian Ocean, and especially its northeastern Andaman Sea, while its Indian counterpart could become more active in the East China Sea. While this summit veritably seemed to give off an anti-Chinese containment vibe, the reality of the matter is that both India and China are currently in the midst of mild rapprochement with the People's Republic, as they seek to balance between it and the US, albeit with uncertain success. Japanese Prime Minister Abe just got back from a landmark visit to China right before hosting his Indian counterpart, which he said signaled an historic turning point in his country's relations with its traditional rival. This is because the two sides agreed to 500 business deals, totaling over $2.5 billion, and a $30 billion currency swap, which came on the heels of India exploring the possibility of replacing newly tariffed American goods with its own in the Chinese marketplace. As it stands, one of three scenarios will probably unfold. India and Japan can indefinitely maintain their complex balancing act, pivot towards the US, or pivot towards China. The first mention would be a continuation of the present, while the second one would tighten the US's containment ring around China. The last scenario, however, is the least likely but the most stabilizing. India and China agreed to cooperate in third-party states earlier this summer before the BRICS summit, which could conceivably see Japan brought into this multilateral arrangement per its newfound deal with New Delhi. The possible convergence of the joint Indo-Japanese-Asia-Africa growth corridor with China's New Silk Road could see these two far-reaching visions entering into a friendly competition with one another to the developmental benefit of global South states, thereby heralding a renaissance. The next one up is Russia dispatching financial advisors to Venezuela upon Caracas's request. The Russian team landed in the country's capital a day after a Chinese delegation, making some wonder whether the two gray powers are coordinating their efforts to save their shared Latin American partners' economy. Both countries have an interest in ensuring the success of President Maduro's latest reforms in order to safeguard the stability of his democratically elected and legitimate government, which is responsible for repaying the loans that they issued it over the past couple of years, and also fulfilling the energy cooperation contracts that were signed between them too. An American-backed regime change could therefore lead to the newly installed authorities backtracking on these commitments and looking for legal loopholes to avoid honoring them, which is why Russia and China's financial advisory assistance to Venezuela should be understood through the perspective of regime reinforcement. Neither of them have the political will or military capabilities to physically defend Venezuela from the hybrid war onslaught that's been directed against it over the past few years, which is why they're providing asymmetrical support instead through their advisory missions that aim to address some of the root causes of legitimate anti-government opposition that's been exploited by foreign actors for color revolution purposes. Venezuela's economy was undermined through a combination of U.S. structural meddling and the government's own missteps, the latter of which are the state's responsibility to rectify. The ideal outcome is that Russia and China's financial advice to Venezuela will contribute to stabilizing its economy and therefore creating the conditions for its many emigrants to return home from the regional countries that they fled to at the height of the hybrid war crisis. Preceding Bolsonaro's victory in Brazil, both great powers urgently plan to prioritize their advisory assistance to Venezuela out of the fear that their notional BRICS partner might invade the country together with Colombia on the pretext of carrying out a so-called humanitarian intervention in response to the highly publicized migrant crisis. The president-elect denied that he was planning any such operation, but the possibility nevertheless exists that he and his generals might change their mind after his inauguration at the beginning of next year, meaning that there's a narrow 2-month window of opportunity for Russia and China to try to preempt the scenario through the indirect advisory means at their disposal. They still might not be able to thwart it, but at the very least, they can help Venezuela be economically stronger when confronting it. Third in our countdown, we have the U.S. proposing that a U.N.-brokered Yemeni peace process begin by December. This suggestion caught some observers by surprise, who hadn't counted on the U.S. contradicting its Saudi ally after Riyadh's almost five-year-long insistence on achieving a total victory. But the recent worsening of relations between the two great powers after Jamal Khashoggi's killing made this all too predictable in hindsight, especially because of the embarrassment that a so-called political compromise could prove to be for Saudi Crown Prince, Defense Minister, and architect of the war on Yemen, Mohammed bin Salman. That's actually part of the reason why the U.S. is doing this, other than, of course, the soft power interest that it has in disingenuously presenting its diplomatic intervention as the only reason why Yemen's humanitarian crisis doesn't reach catastrophic proportions, despite American backing for the Saudi-led campaign being one of the reasons why the situation has deteriorated as much as it has. In the realm of realpolitik, the U.S. is fully aware that a political solution to the war on Yemen would likely lead to the de facto partition of the country, largely along the lines of its pre-1990 division into a largely autonomous North Yemen and a UAE-influenced South Yemen, possibly legitimized through forthcoming constitutional changes that might promulgate a federal system. The Saudis would doubly lose in that case because they hardly have any influence over North Yemen, while it would be risky for them to compete with their Emirati allies in South Yemen, especially when considering that Abu Dhabi's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed is supposedly MBS's mentor. So Riyadh would essentially be left with no tangible benefit after spending billions upon billions of dollars on this campaign over nearly the past half decade. Still, it's difficult to think of any other scenario for resolving this conflict. Faced with the fait accompli of their American ally basically backstabbing them with this abrupt turnaround, which, despite its Machiavellian intentions, is nevertheless a positive step in the direction of seriously ending this war, the most pragmatic recourse that Riyadh has is to seek Russia's balancing services in having Moscow diplomatically intervene as a counterweight to U.S. influence over this process. Russian-Saudi relations are currently at their best ever level in history, while Russia also enjoys excellent ties with the UAE and Yemen. So it's sensible to see it play a neutral mediating role within the forthcoming UN broker talks, especially considering that the country is also a member of the Security Council. This could prospectively see Russia ensuring the fair interest of each respective Yemeni half, as well as the two very close but somewhat competing Gulf kingdoms, even if it ends up irking Iran. Our runner-up is Canada accepting over 100 so-called white helmets from Syria. Popularly described as neutral civilian volunteers and humanitarian rescuers, this organization was proven by investigative journalists Vanessa Bealey and Eva Bartlett to be linked to terrorist groups, which makes Canada's rolling out of the red carpet for them especially controversial considering its recent tiff with Saudi Arabia over the kingdom's alleged violation of human rights. What's clearly happening here is that Canada evidently has a hierarchy of human rights violators, albeit one that's only selectively enforced when it politically suits the country to do so. Prime Minister Trudeau is a liberal globalist who tries to embrace this ideology's zeitgeist at any given moment, as opposed to ever taking an independent decision. So in hindsight, he can be said to have acted against the Saudis because he felt like it was the popular thing to do, while he welcomed the white helmets for the very same reason. There is more to it though than just blatant hypocrisy if one takes the time to analyze his country's decision. The white helmets are part of a global hybrid war network that was put to devastatingly effective use in the war on Syria before being exposed by the aforementioned independent journalist. And Canada may have been obliged by its NATO allies to do its part in supporting this group upon its recent Israeli-assisted evacuation from the Arab Republic. Canada's very lenient immigration regime that practically amounts to a policy of open borders made the country an ideal destination for these terrorist-linked forces to flee to, where the government could always try to justify its decision under any future pressure on the grounds of guilting the populace into accepting what the mainstream media portrays as innocent victims of the Assad regime, even though that's clearly not what they are. What's important to keep in mind is that the growing global awareness of the white helmets' true activities in Syria might eventually cause some Canadians to doubt the wisdom of their prime minister in letting these very controversial individuals into the country. There's already a visible trend sweeping the world of conservative movements toppling liberal governments, or at the very least hamstringing them, like what recently happened in Germany, so it wouldn't be all too unexpected if this helped fuel the flames of a similar movement in Canada that could chip away at Trudeau's support. There's still another year to go before Canadians head to the polls to decide whether he stays on as prime minister or is replaced by what could be a conservative politician, so it remains to be seen whether his warm welcome to the white helmets figures into that upcoming campaign or not. At our top spot, we've got Trump ordering up to 15,000 US troops to the Mexican border in response to the approaching caravan, with some fearing that he intends to take kinetic action against it. From the looks of it, the president might be preparing to order a limited incursion into Mexico to stop the caravan from reaching American soil, which is something that controversial conservative commentator Ann Coulter recently urged him to do, alongside some of his supporters on Twitter who even begged Trump to bomb it well before it reaches the border. His recent Twitter description of the caravan as an invasion of our country caused some to contemplate whether he'd instruct the military to deal with it as forcibly as any other sovereign country would react to an actual invasion. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen, however, earlier clarified that we do not have any intention right now to shoot at people, elaborating that if they come here illegally with no legitimate reason to stay, they absolutely will be apprehended and removed immediately, but nevertheless reaffirming that the Border Patrol does have the ability, of course, to defend themselves. Trump seemed to signal the same sentiment when he said that the government planned to build so-called tent cities to house legitimate asylum seekers while they await processing, which could conceivably be expedited following the executive order that he issued earlier this year during the first caravan crisis. This seems to confirm what Volks reported about how the military will probably play a very important back-end logistical role as opposed to the dramatic frontline one that many people might be expecting, because of legal limitations on what it can and cannot do in this respect. Altogether, however, the deployment will do good on Trump's promise to improve border security in the face of what some could categorize as being part of Kelly M. Greenhill's so-called weapons of mass migration model, especially if Pence's claim about leftist groups in Venezuela funding the caravan turns out to be true. There's convincing circumstantial evidence that this might indeed be the case when considering that many of the migrants refused Mexico's generous offer to provide them with shelter, medical care, schooling, and even jobs because they insisted that they be let into the U.S., which is undoubtedly very suspicious behavior if they were true asylum seekers fleeing from their homeland's turmoil to the first safe space available. This strange reaction gives credence to the narrative that shadowy forces are funding their journey for political purposes, which explains why Trump felt compelled to crack down on illegal immigration in order to deter them and any copycat caravans from crossing the border. Not only will they be met by the military and detained in 10 cities, but he also wants to change the law via an executive order to remove the controversial concept of birthright citizenship that some non-citizens abuse through so-called anchor babies and the chain migration that follows. Trump, therefore, more than likely isn't going to invade Mexico, but is rather buffering America's border defenses to prevent it from being invaded through Mexico by weapons of mass migration. All of his moves align with furthering this objective, be it militarizing the border, building tent cities, expediting asylum claims, and doing whatever he can to get rid of the Constitution's anchor baby interpretation that has hitherto been abused. Taken together, Trump's policy towards illegal immigration is intended to serve as a powerful deterrent that contributes to curtailing these large-scale human flows even before his celebrated border wall is completed. And the off chance that some of the alleged gang members and other provocateurs in the caravan clash with the Border Patrol, then there should be no doubt that the U.S. will respond accordingly. But it's highly unlikely that any incursions will be made into Mexican territory. All right, folks, so there you have it. This wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown. And as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for tuning into my program. Hope you all have a nice rest of your week and tune in again next time. Thanks. Bye.